Good morning and welcome to the Crawford Stewardship Podcast. I am your host, Joseph Childs, and today my guest is Monique Hassman. Monique is the GIS Coordinator / Land Information Officer at the Vernon County Land Information Office. Today we are going to discuss the role of land information offices in our rural communities, as well as the opportunities for creating and using maps to enhance rural quality of life. Once again, this is Crawford Stewardship Podcast, brought to you by Crawford Stewardship Project and WDRT 91.9 FM, where the show airs every third Monday of the month at 9:30 a.m. The full-length episode can be found alongside many others at WDRT.org and CrawfordStewardship.org. Welcome, Monique, and thank you for joining me today to talk about such an interesting topic. I'm a bit of a map nerd myself, so when I met you at the Watershed Council meeting, we started talking about maps. I knew we had to get you on the podcast at some point. But a couple things that I still am a little foggy about is what exactly your official position is and what does that entail? What does a land information officer do?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for inviting me here to speak with you and those listening. As mentioned, my name is Monique, and at present I hold the role as a GIS coordinator / land information officer for Vernon County, located in the Driftless region of Wisconsin, a county that shares a boundary with six neighboring counties, two states, and the mighty Mississippi River. I've been in this role for about 2 years. However, I have a longer relationship with Vernon County. For some time, I've been working in various capacities. I began as a GIS technician back in 2009. I was a land and water conservation intern, and previously I was a watershed planner before landing into this position. So long story short, I just can't seem to get enough of public servant work.
That's usually not the role that people take, I guess. They usually end up in public service after, you know, years of private work. But so what drew you to, you know, it seems like you spend a lot of time with the outdoors and the land and conservation. So what drew you to that?
So it's a bit unconventional, the path to this, you know, to this role here. But I bring to this position training as a social scientist with a passion for people, plants, and places. Throughout my higher education career, it's pretty much been interdisciplinary, an endeavor of like cultural and applied anthropology as well as GIS.
And when you say GIS, what exactly does that mean? I hear it a lot, and I'm ashamed to say that I don't. Okay. I understand kind of what it is, but not exactly what it stands for.
No shame. This is a safe space. GIS, depending on who you ask, it can be defined as a geographic information system. In academia, we refer to it as a geographic information sciences. So people change what the acronym stands for depending on who they're talking to. But in essence, it's a technology that allows us to spatially display information, and that information can be both qualitative and quantitative data. Coming from a background of anthropology, I'm more drawn to the qualitative data that one can acquire through field work, participant observation, conducting interviews, doing life histories. But GIS can be fairly limited, at least it had been. It's definitely evolving to push the boundaries of what we can and cannot display, and that's kind of been a challenge along the way. If I may, what brought me to this, I also was ignorant of what GIS was. It was when I was going to school for my master's in anthropology. And
we should say what anthropology is, too, because for a long time I thought that was, I confused it with archaeology.
Oh, that's great. Yes, yeah, so anthropology, the study of humans. And if you study anthropology in the United States, we take a four-field approach. And so that would be linguistics, so how people talk, would be about the biology or physical anthropology, you know, like the makeup of our bodies. And then we have archaeology, which is past, you know, societies or remains, cultural remains and artifacts. And then we have cultural anthropology, which is like looking at contemporary people and societies. Typically, anthropology is considered study of small-scale society, where sociology is large-scale society, but we often study the same social theories, but our methodologies tend to diverge a bit.
I thought we were, when I had to ask you in here, I thought it was going to be like maps and stuff like that, but this seems way deeper than just like, here's some data plotted on a map. And also, I'm a terrible host. Amy Fenn is here, my boss. So thanks for coming in, Amy. Sorry I didn't introduce you, but that was who was asking that question. My voice did not just get very different for a second there. So you said this is a weird, you know, a weird path to, you know, in Vernon County making maps, but you came from the anthropology side. So what was it about GIS and this sort of field that drew you to this field as a career?
So that story goes, I was going to school for cultural anthropology. My master's at UW-Milwaukee. And at the time, my advisor, Dr. Cheryl Ajiro-Tutu, let me know that her students, she requires them to take to double master to get a professional degree because no one would actually hire us as just a cultural anthropologist. Surprise, surprise. And so she, with the options that were available, she just mentioned to me, I think you need to look into GIS. I signed up for my first course, no idea what this was about, walked into the classroom day one and learned it was maps. And like Amy, fell in love with this, you know, with this world of map making and cartography, the art and science of place. And so I ran back to her office after the class and was like, this is it. I love it. This is perfect because I'm able to be detail focused and not just theoretical with the cultural anthropology side, but you can create tangible products. And I really was drawn to the GIS world. However, I remember my first GIS course, one of the exercises was identifying potential drug houses in the city of Milwaukee, and there was a certain criteria that we had to use to identify those. And I remember raising my hand, asking, whose criteria is this that we're using? Why was this criteria chosen? I was questioning along the way. And I was, in essence, told, don't worry about those questions, just do the exercise. And then I went back to anthropology department, and I was like, oh, I'm learning this great tool so that we can not just focus on voice or narrative, which is often, you know, what we look at in anthropology, but we can, like, look at place and the multi-vocalness of place. And it's a great tool in our toolbox. We aren't using, and there was hesitation because of the military connotations associated with the use of GIS. Particularly, it was at the Gulf War at the time, and so there was hesitancy about this technology being used and how it was being used in the world. And so I felt like I was in between two different worlds, and I didn't fit in either way. I was asking too many social questions in geography and urban planning department, and it was too technical of a skill for anthropology, for what we do as anthropologists. But it was something that I embraced, excuse me, this interdisciplinary endeavor. I employed spatial data to understand the human experience with my master's thesis, which explored complexities of practicing agriculture within an urban context. And then later on in my dissertation, I examined socio-spatial terrains and the aftermath of disaster. And
it seems like this... like your position is a crossroads of all the things you're interested in. Like it's blending technology and on the ground truth and also people, because there's a reason these maps are being created. It's something that people are using. It's a tool that we would like to have to identify drug houses, apparently, which I don't know how that would work, but I guess it does.
Well, let's unpack that a little bit, because maybe that's, or choose an example. It doesn't have to be that one, but it's something I hadn't seen until I did take a grad school class in GIS, and that was, I had used maps before, but just like in a geography textbook or a history textbook especially. I think I had kind of an epiphany in college where instead of just learning history through the story of, you know, country A and country B were at war, and then in college that got translated onto maps where I can see, oh, well, there's actually a very important river right in between these two countries that they can't grow food unless they have access to that water. And so, like, suddenly it makes sense why they're at war with each other. And then when I took a GIS class, they introduced adding data to that and asking questions and trying to help have the map itself help us answer those questions. So I think we were chatting before we started recording here, but I gave an example of, like, in if there's a disease outbreak in a country, that you can start feeding in the records of what doctor's offices are reporting cases of this and spread them out and make a map of where they're appearing and then come up with a plan on where you're going to start vaccinating first in order to counteract that, where it's this living tool, not just a reference. And so when you say about mapping drug houses or trying to, it sounds like you're maybe saying trying to figure out where they are. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit more about how you use maps to do that? And maybe that's the data sets that were becoming kind of controversial or?
Oof. Yeah, that's, So this I feel like I need to just back up. So one of the things that attracted me to, like, this realm of the conversation about looking at, you know, what kind of data are we looking at? What are the power dynamics behind the data? What are the nuances? What is the story a map is trying to tell? How do we convey information in a particular way? Can be extremely challenging to the notion that there's objective knowledge to so much that becomes on a map, whether, but along the way we're making choices about whether we have north at the top versus the south, or, you know, how we imagine scale and what we choose. These along the way are subjective choices that get made along the way. So from the very beginning, when we're talking about map making, there is human decisions that get made into the creation of these products. And I think what made me most excited in the academic career leading me here was finding out that there's this realm of work that initially referred to as GIS and society. And that was examining some of these topics that we're talking about today in the background of the data and questioning of power dynamics and authorities. And then that later went into what's referred to as critical GIS, which is another realm that examines reflexivity. It looks at the production of knowledge. It looks at GIS and mapping technologies as social constructions. All of that gets at, Amy, what you're talking about. What is this behind this work that we do that makes me so excited to talk about this with somebody that's interested in entertaining these conversations.
Yeah, it's definitely a different, the depth of knowledge that you have is apparent, and it's definitely a different conversation than I had imagined when I first invited you to the podcast, but I think it's probably a much more interesting one than I had thought of. Got to do a little pause here for a station identification break. This is WDRT 91.9 FM, and you are listening to the Crawford Stewardship Podcast, brought to you by Crawford Stewardship Project. And this program airs at 9:30 a.m. on the third Monday of every month. You can find this episode, as well as many others, on WDRT.org. So to jump back into our conversation here with Monique, we were talking about, you had mentioned that no matter how good a map is, at the very beginning of the creation, there is human assumptions and data and definitions that are plugged in. So just to use, I hate to keep bringing up the drug house in Milwaukee reference, but it's the only one I've got in my head right now. So in order to identify those, you first have to define what you're looking for and put the parameters into, you know, you could, if you really wanted to, you could put in, you know, yellow houses within five blocks of a grocery store, and that you could define that as a drug house. Probably not a good definition, but at some point you have to define what you're looking for, and then the map's just showing you the accumulation of all those the responses or the report of the criteria that you put in. So long-winded point to bring it back around to, how does this affect, how do maps and people in your position affect the daily lives, or maybe not daily, but the lives of people that they're serving? It's a public service position. What are the things that you do in your position, or the others in your position do, that affect people's lives?
Thanks for bringing it back. So in this role, one of the things that we provide at Vernon County is, if you go to the Vernon County website, one of the resources that's provided to the public is a GIS map. We call it the Public Interactive Web Map, and that's one of a few web maps that we make available to folk. And what that in essence does is, it is, if you go online, it's a image with an aerial image of Vernon County. And those aerial images we acquire at Vernon County every 5 years is the cadence. Digital orthophotography is quite expensive, and so we write grants and fund these, you know, this acquisition different ways. But my predecessor was on a 5-year acquisition, and so we just did a flyover in 2025. This spring here had to be a cloudless day and had to be where the snow is off the ground, and we do leaf off so that we can have a better view of the landscape. And so we're really excited that will come out later this year.
So you commission your own map, like, or images like that? I, for some reason, just assumed that it was like Google, like there's some satellite up there and it's already taking pictures and you just buy what they have, but...
That they are doing that, and we also are doing that. And so, you know, what is the? Well, let me back up. So, like, over time for Vernon County, we've gone from 1 meter resolution to 12-inch. The last 2020 aerial image is what we have available on the website now. That's 6-inch pixel resolution.
Okay.
So, what do you mean by 6-inch pixel resolution? I imagine it's better than 1 meter, but what exactly
right.
does
and
that
so,
mean?
Right. Yeah, so 6 inches on the ground is 1 pixel on the computer screen.
So, essentially, it's much, much higher detail than
exactly.
originally.
Exactly. And we're excited to share. We'll unveil here in this moment that we were able to acquire grant funding from the state of Wisconsin and provided by the Ho-Chunk Nation, that we are getting support to acquire 3-inch aerial imagery for 2025. And so the resolution will be even more robust and rich. Compared to, you know, what we have in the past. But these are great that we have these captured, these snapshots in time on our website, and we refer to them as base maps. And so you can look at, say, if you have property or you're interested in a particular region of the county, you can look at it in 2020 versus 2015 and 2010, going back to 2005. And so that's neat to see that transformation of the landscape. And then in addition to that, Vernon County acquires LIDAR data, which is an acronym for Light Detection and Ranging, which in essence is... capturing a very detailed analysis of the landscape. And so these light pulses get shot down from a plane, typically. And what it does is, the light pulse, once it hits its first point of resistance, that might be a tree canopy, it might be a building, it might be the surface of the ground, the machine times the light pulse from, you know, how long it takes to the first point of resistance, second point, and then how long it takes to get back. And that's how it creates millions of points on the ground. And so LIDAR is just a really rich data set that can be used for a variety of things. But in Vernon County, we acquired it. My predecessor, Doug Avalos, acquired it in 2010. And then we acquired it again in 2020. So now we're on a 10-year cadence for that. And that is really exciting data because that allows us to create contour data from that.
Because it's elevation data, the LIDAR is, right?
Yes, and so we're really excited that we have, like, some people refer to, like, 10-foot contours or 5-foot, right, the spaces in between, the elevation being the same along that line. We have, we have 1-foot contours that we can provide through this LIDAR, which is, like, really exciting to have for, you know, various products.
I used that on my own farm. I didn't... I have a little 40-acre square, and when I bought it, it had been used for haying, and it was sort of burnt out. And so I wanted to turn it into grazing, and I used both the satellite map so that I could see. It's rolling hills, and there's not really any place that you can stand that you can see the whole of what you're working with. So the satellite image was good so that I could just see where do I want to walk, where do I want a road to be. And then I used the LiDAR data because I wanted to put my fence lines on contour so that because it's rolling hills and I'm walking around a lot, I'm like, I will be a lot less fatigued if I can be walking on straight lines, and a way I can show myself where the straight lines are is to put fences on them, and I'll just walk along the fence line. So I did that with the LiDAR data, and I was able to just, I went to my county office, this was in Crawford County, and Dave T. gave me the file for my property, and I was able to load that into my phone, and I could walk around my farm with my phone open, and it would show me exactly when I was walking along a contour line. So, like, I think that's, I could never have done that if the county government hadn't provided me with that. That would be inaccessible to me as an individual, I think, or at least very expensive.
Yeah. Well, that's an awesome point just to raise that, like, these are resources that are available for people, and I hope you have Mapper on your resume now that you've been doing that work.
I just like going on and looking at the LiDAR data sometimes, because it's not the same as, like, an aerial photo. If people are thinking, you know, it's an image from a plane, it's, there are, like you said, millions and millions of points, so it can actually get through tree canopies as well, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So because there's so many points, just this, the breeze of the wind going back and forth moves the leaves enough that it can get a point on the ground even in densely wooded areas, which is, it may not sound that impressive, but that is extremely impressive to be able to take contour lines in woods without having to ground truth those with an A-frame level and moving that, you know, 3 feet at a time. So it's incredibly, incredibly impressive. And in a slightly less impressive way that I use maps is I find a lot of really good fishing spots with those, with those maps.
That's interesting. Folks use LiDAR for a variety of reasons. I mean, one of the neat things in this area is that you can see effigy mounds. You can also see, you know, where timber roads are located. We can use it for a variety of resources. Right now, it's interesting that we have the snapshots of 2020 and 2010 when we think of the decommissioning of the PL-566 flood control structures, with some of them being compromised in the 2018 flooding. What does that look like on the landscape between those years? Because that happened in 2018, we can see that difference when we compare those two data sets.
I would imagine the capability to do such highly detailed maps, and especially contour mapping, is extremely important in planning for infrastructure due to flooding, because you can get right down to the very nitty gritty of where watersheds and where water is going to flow in a flood, and pairing that data with the NAST data that shows what areas are covered by perennial grass and what areas are woodland and what areas are annual crops. You know, pairing that data with the contour would help you plan, like, this bridge needs to be actually a box culvert instead of just a road tube and stuff like that, which helps our local government and our, obviously, the people traveling the roads avoid, you know, dangerous situations such as that.
Mm-hmm. It's exciting at Vernon County that we are using GIS in neat ways that are getting at some of these issues of flooding that have plagued the area. And if I may just share two examples, is one is Vernon County is a recipient of a BRIC grant from FEMA, which is an acronym for Building Resilient Infrastructures and Communities. And what the initiative with that grant was to, we realized we were sitting on, with our emergency management director, so much data, a plethora of data from presidentially declared disasters of where we've had flooding happen in the county. I'm talking Tupperware containers and files stored in basements, some beginning to collect mold on it. Wow. And so what we decided was, while it's exciting to collect new shiny data, and it's not so glitzy and glamorous to look at, you know, the old data, but what we decided to do with some of this BRIC grant funding was to create a data set of where we have had flooding and damage. And so we have worked with interns over the last few years, teaching them how to use GIS and going through the FEMA paperwork and going and putting on points on a map. GIS is typically, our vector data is based off of either points, lines, or polygons. And the points are where there's points of damage, whether that's to a culvert, to a road, maybe a blowout. And then the line data has to do with, like, say, if there was a length of road that was impacted, that we'd be able to mark from point A to point B using GPS coordinates. And then polygons would be like, say, if a park was impacted, damaged from this. And so we've gone through and we've archived this data going back to flooding in 2007 to, I believe, 2018 now. And so what this robust data set can show us, how it gets used, is where are there areas of repetitive damage happening in the county so that we can use it and, you know, work with our highway department and say, you know, what is it that we can look at here? Work with our land and water folk and say, you know, what kind of conservation practices can we put on the ground to encourage infiltration in these areas? And then also it becomes particularly useful to demonstrate on a map, that's that authority that a map can offer when you're writing a grant application and you can show where that repetitive damage is. That's one of two exciting ways we're using GIS right now when it comes to flooding.
That was literally going to be my next point or question. That was this something that now that you've got this data, you can use even further? So it's not just here's this cool data, it's here's this cool data, but also this is something we can use to say, hey, we've actually got a lot of damage here and we should be the ones receiving some funding, because it is a competitive world for funding, and unfortunately not everyone can get all the funding they need after a disaster such as flooding. But if, you know, we've done the legwork and we've got the data that says, you know, this is a more important spot than maybe over there because there's more damage, then that helps out the community. So what I'm really hearing is there's a lot of kind of behind-the-scenes things you don't think about when you're driving over a culvert. You don't think about the person like Monique that's sitting in her office and helping get these things repaired and building the maps that prevent them from being damaged. Maybe you don't think about her when you're fishing out on the river either, but I know I use maps a lot to find areas like that. So
Joe, that's exciting. I'm wondering if you are aware that we have a fishing easements map on the Vernon County website as well, which my predecessor mapped, being a fisher person himself. So that's one of the, we've got that one, and then we have a road closures map, snowmobile maps, trails. And then, of course, the public interactive, which I only really shared that we offer the base maps of that. That has a variety of other data sets available if anybody's had a chance to go on, that you can toggle on and off these different layers from parks to the PLS corners, property lines, our best interpretation of or our estimates for tax purposes. There's school districts, voting areas, there's address points on there. Wow. So there's a variety of data that's available to people to toggle in and off, in and on and off, you know. Floodplain mapping is also available on there that is of interest. But what's really exciting is just when we have somebody come into the office and they're excited about, can you just show me where my land is?
Yeah, that's a great teaser to get people to listen to the second half of this episode online at WDRT.org. But for right now, we're going to wrap up the radio portion. We're going to continue the conversation with Monique here and dive into even more things that maps can do for us here in Crawford and Vernon County. This has been the Crawford Stewardship Podcast. I'm your host, Joseph Childs, and sitting down here today with both Amy Fenn and Monique Hassman. Monique is the GIS coordinator / land information officer at the Vernon County Land Information Office. And we were going to discuss more stuff about the Land Information Office here in the second half, and we've talked a little bit about the history of maps and how Monique got into this career. You can listen to this show every third Monday of the month at 9:30 a.m. on WDRT 91.9 FM. Thanks for joining us today, and head over to the website to listen to the rest. Bye. So, Monique, we talked a little bit about how maps are used and the cool ways that GIS is using these maps for all sorts of different things. And maybe one of the less flashy, cool, sexy things is using them for comprehensive planning. And I had looked through the Vernon County Comprehensive Planning document, and it was really cool to see there's a vast amount of maps in there that are put together, I assume, by partners within the county, maybe outside the county coming in for professional help as well. But there was one that showed the suitability of development, and that one struck me as like, how exactly do you define that, and how do you make a map? Because it's cool to think that there are very smart and thoughtful people out there working for the public saying, you know, we shouldn't just sprawl out in every direction because some directions might be more environmentally susceptible. Some places might have farmland that's prime farmland. We don't want to use that up. So are there parameters that you use that are put into this equation? And then what are the limitations? You know, everything's not going to be perfect, but can you speak on that just a little?
Sure. Yeah, I was able to be a advisor, Vernon County staff member of the Planning Commission, and we worked in partnership with our friends at the Mississippi River Regional Planning Commission, who worked on a variety of those maps that you mentioned, Joe. Perhaps one of the that sparked a lot of interest was the suitability for growth. And so looking at the county, different parameters were looked at, such as buildable land, perhaps slope, maybe not putting buildings on, 20% or, whatnot.
Growth meaning like infrastructure growth.
Correct, right, and building suitability as well. And so how do we connect to infrastructure that's already in place, be it roads or water lines? And does it make sense to have those by our city centers or our villages and grow from there? But those maps sparked rich discussion, sometimes difficult dialogues about what was appropriate. There's many ideas. When you put it on a map, it's a recommendation, it's a theory, it's an idea, a suggestion. That doesn't mean that there's teeth to it, that it's going to be implemented. But if we are going to continue to grow, people are going to continue to move to this area, where does it make sense and in a thoughtful way? And so this is what has come up in the plan. However, we'll see where it goes from there.
Mm-hmm. So, and Amy, you have a background in urban planning. Is this something that were you learning about using this? Is this something that has been, this isn't a new idea, I would assume. It obviously hasn't been around a long time because there are some cities that have sprawled just endlessly. But is this something that an urban planner would use in their daily life?
That's how I got interested in it, as I grew up in Los Angeles, which is famous for sprawl. And then I moved to Portland, Oregon area for college. And at the time, a big conversation there was about an urban growth boundary, that they'd basically drawn a ring around the city and said, we are not going to sprawl past this road. You could literally drive on it, and on the right-hand side of the road was development, and on the left-hand side of the road was a farm field. And I studied urban planning there because I thought, how wonderful to have a conversation about let's take what we have and manage within this, instead of just saying, oh, let's screw this planet up and then move to the moon. It's like, let's do it right in the space that we have, and that makes it more livable and walkable for the people who are here and the growing population, because the better we manage it, the more people will want to come here. The reason I dropped out of it is because they are very difficult conversations to have, because people don't, including myself, it's like, if you like things how they are, you don't want them to change. And it's hard to have conversations that have to start with acknowledging things are going to change. And what we have to talk about is how we are going to manage that change in advance. So we can't really have a conversation about, well, I don't want anyone else to move here, because that's going to happen. And the conversation that we can have is about, how do we want to manage that, like in order to keep things livable, keep what we value, and make things fair and things. And it's hard to start those conversations and have them. They're very challenging for everyone.
Well, Amy, I really appreciate you mentioning that. That was a perennial topic that came up in the development of the plan, particularly about where new development is happening. There are measures that you can put into place to either suggest in one direction or another. Vernon County at this time does not have a comprehensive zoning or anything like that. So what we see these days, one of the things that our office does is we work very closely with the sheriff's office and the dispatch where they do the addressing for Vernon County. And so on a daily basis, our office is receiving GPS points of where people are building structures, an address point for where a 911 officer would be dispatched to. And so we have a site access point as well as building points. And it's interesting in those discussions, the comprehensive planning discussions of, well, folks typically aren't building in like a agricultural field, but we are finding on a weekly basis that we are putting this data point, which seems insignificant, but you're putting it onto the middle of perhaps prime ag land to build a home. And if they're, you know, it's an interesting to see where people are choosing to develop at their own whim these days. But I guess I would just like to say, you know, like our office, we're putting these points on a map, and sometimes we forget that there's lives behind these points. Mm-hmm. You know, that it is imperative that we put it in the correct place. As simplistic as that task may be, and that there are real people behind that. Another, you know, realm of this work was we had realized when I first came into this role, I was contacted by the state who was looking at the school districts and let us know that we had two, three parcels that were erroneous in they were in the wrong school district. And I said, well, let's just clean up the data. You know, I want to have, you know, the most accurate, you know, clean data set that we can have. And I had to pause and remember that, sure, we can put those parcels in different school districts, but are there children living in those homes? And if there are, are their lives going to be disrupted of what school district they're going to be going to? There are real life, you know, ramifications that come about from these boundaries that we draw, whether polygons or points on a map. And yeah, it's important that we have folks that are making these maps consider these realms along the way.
Yeah, that would as a child that open enrolled, that would have been devastating for me to like just switch, hey, you've got to go to this school next year. Like, oh no. So yeah, if you get stuck in that, you know, this is my job, these are points, I want the cleanest data, like there are real world issues that arise that you can't predict for. And being a farmer as well, that is something like I've talked at length about, like farming on paper, you can make all the best plans and all that stuff, but a high windstorm comes in and knocks on your corn, or a tree falls down and lets your cows out. Like, your plans don't really mean much. You have to be on the ground seeing that.
Where do those conversations take place about the considerations and how to make hard decisions, or include as considerations, and how to approach them? Are there like professional associations?
Well, that is such a great question. So they take place in various realms. One of them would be definitely in the immediate land information office, second floor of the annex building, right next door to the Dragon Park in downtown Viroqua, in our office with our colleagues. We also have, when you receive funding from the state of Wisconsin, from the Wisconsin Land Information Program, which we do to support providing land information to the public through our land information office and through a land information officer, we are also required by statute to have a land information council. And on the council, we have various members of our staff, from emergency management to the real property lister, the register of deeds, the county surveyor. We do have someone from, you know, a realtors association. We also have the county conservationist additionally on the team, as well as the zoning administrator, because so much of the work that they do is related to land information. And so sometimes we bring these discussions to the Land Information Council and collectively determine, you know, best next steps. So it's not just one individual. Mm-hmm. So that's really helpful to work by consensus and have that information. And then beyond that, another, we're going to go to scale talking about this, the social dynamics here, is we have what's referred to as the Wisconsin Land Information Association. And I just became a board member of that, so I'm very excited to promo that. But they are another resource that pulls together professionals working in and around land information-related topics. So any kind of professional that deals with land, place, is invited to the conferences, become part of the organization, and then help develop some of those stories.
Yeah. Those sound like interesting conferences, because there's, I mean, all sorts of people would be there, you would think. I'd imagine county conservationists, surveyors, people in your position, like a lot of different people coming together, because we're talking about land and information regarding land and the uses of it. So, I mean, almost everyone is using land for something. So there's a lot of people that are affected by that.
Yes, it is a diverse group of folk coming together. What I look forward to is pathing, like my path crossing with other folk that like to talk about things within the realm of placemaking or sense of place, which is a little bit harder to map and maybe a bit more esoteric in the GIS world, but really exciting. Like, how do we capture stories of place in a map? You know, can our GIS embed audiovisual, you know, links? It can now. When I was in school, it wasn't so much able to. There's also what's referred to as story maps now, which can be a dynamic way to see dynamically changing data in real time, couched within, you know, other, you know, information about a particular topic.
So I think I've been to a website where, as I moved my mouse over a map, if I hovered in a place long enough, a little tiny video would show up mm-hmm. with somebody who lived there saying a little something about what their life was like or something. Mm-hmm. Is that
yeah? That's exactly
along the lines
yes.
of what.
Yeah, I really get excited about those different strategies to make the maps come off the paper or become alive. Mm-hmm. Place name maps always intrigue me. A gentleman in the Wisconsin Land Information Association worked on creating, you know, a map of Wisconsin from First Nations or Indigenous names of places, Menominee. And so you can, click the audio of the different places of the map, you know, challenging conventional ways or Western ways, epistemology of knowing Wisconsin as a place. So I get excited about those different ways of, you know, how we embody, experience, place, and then in this format.
That you're talking about the audio video ones, that got me thinking of Wisconsinites really need to make an interactive map for people that live outside of Wisconsin on how to pronounce the cities that they're hovering over. So when they go to them, they don't mispronounce the cities.
Ask and you shall receive. It's already out there, and I'm happy to send you the map.
That's cool. I'll share that with my friends outside of Wisconsin.
It's a bit of comic relief to go through. How do we actually say that as a Wisconsinite to confirm one way or another?
You had talked about zoning department earlier, and we were also talking about, you know, tough conversations, and mm-hmm. zoning is often at this forefront of those tough conversations. Some people really like it. Some people really, really hate it. So what exactly does zoning mean? If Vernon County had comprehensive zoning, what exactly does that entail? Or is this something that maybe...
Yeah, that's really early, almost too early to even talk about. Those discussions haven't been on the table yet. That'd be great discussion for Matt Albright, Vernon County's zoning administrator. What my role in that realm would be to make sure that any data that's needed, maybe it's demographics, maybe it's population density, would be to make the data available so that people can make data-driven decisions. That's the power behind, you know, GIS and hopefully making thoughtful considerations.
And that seems to cross, not seems, it does cross over very much with what Crawford Stewardship Project does, is not so much, here's the decision that we want you guys to make, that's not what we want to bring forward. It's, we would like everyone that's going to be affected to come together and make the decision. we're not saying what decision what needs to be made. It's just, hey, if you're affected by this, your voice should be heard. Let's come together. And you know, you're probably not going to get 100% your way, but you're not going to get 100% mad about the decision either, as long as you're part of the decision. And part of making informed decisions is having all the stakeholders, but also having all the information. And it seems like that is exactly what your department would do. It's land information. So I would hope that you guys have lots of that.
Yeah, we do. We do try to make as much data open source or publicly available, particularly when it's funded with taxpayer dollars, to make it easily available. We do customization of maps for folks. We do a lot of mapping for our fire departments, ambulance districts. We do mapping work for nonprofit organizations. It's very common that researchers contact our office for data. So we are, in essence, a clearinghouse. We're stewards, if you will, custodians of land information for Vernon County, going back to when it was initially surveyed. And so it's a tall order, and we're always looking to expand our geospatial data library.
So do you have like a library that's also a paper library then?
We also have a paper library. So we have all the surveys that we know about. We house them physically in our office. And then surveyors, after they make a survey, they have, by statute, 60 days to get a copy to our office. So we house the physical copies of those in our office, and those are available to the public during office hours. And then we also map and make available online a plat of survey. If it's a CSM, we map that we have it available, but because it's recorded, you have to go to the Register of Deeds to pay for a copy of it. But the plat of surveys we make available online.
That's cool.
Yeah, it's publicly available.
I've used those a few times in my custom grazing. I'm just going and seeing who owns what land, and then some landowners, they want to see some information about their land, and I direct them to that. So I've pulled a few of those for my landowners.
Yeah. Yeah, so like if someone was to want to go to the website and click on a parcel, maybe that is theirs or maybe they're interested in, you can click on it, and then there's a link for more information that takes us to our tax parcel database, and you can go and learn about how the land is assessed, the different assessment codes. You can see who's owned it. You can see what year, going back to, I believe, 2000, what was paid on the property. What the mailing address is of that individual. So it's just really got a lot of information that is publicly available that a lot of folk don't even know that it's available and out there.
So there's a, I don't know if you've heard of the app called Onyx.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hunting app, but it's really just a geographical survey map. I mean, it shows a lot of, it's got aerial images, but you can also go on there and it pulls from the public data and it stays very up to date. The data that like offices like yours are providing, it's even more easily accessible because there are companies out there that have actually said, like, hey, people want this. Let's make it super easily available. And there's an app on your phone that you can go and find the mailing address, the parcel number, all this kind of stuff. It just happens to be used for like hunting, but I use it for grazing often because I want to see who owns that pasture that there's no cows on and that maybe I can rent.
Two things about the Onyx app. That's great that you mentioned that, Joe. One is that the data that private companies like Onyx is using is the Wisconsin Land Information Program, which supports offices such as ours, is that we are required by statute to produce parcel data once a year. And that is a collaborative effort with the 72 counties across the state. We have to submit. It's typically a March 31st date. And then that gets made available on the Department of Administration, I believe, website in the State Cartography Office. And private companies then can use that data to then customize it for folks in like hunting apps. So the second piece I want to mention to that is that it's a fairly common practice to have someone come through our office doors and say, well, on the Onyx app, it shows. and we're familiar with it shows because they're getting their data from counties that are making it publicly mm-hmm. available. And so we're familiar with what's available, but the county... I believe it's the Wisconsin Professional Land Surveying Association and the Wisconsin County Surveyors Association have put out a a white paper of sorts, a statement about the limitations of using apps like Onyx to understand where property line boundaries are located. And so, you know, that's an interesting thing to share with folk, you know, that come into our office who, you know, want to use these as ways to understand on the to ground truth what these lines are that we're looking at on these computer apps.
Yeah, usually it's a... It'll get you in the area, but you always look for a fence or a posting.
Yeah, they
it
are
can be
ish.
You know, 25, 30 feet off. And
yes,
sometimes
there are disclaimers that that this should not take the place of a survey done by a professional landsurveyor.
So you mentioned, you know, the 72 counties coming together for that sort of thing. Are there other maybe like regional projects that counties come together on, you know, like the Driftless region or like Crawford, Vernon, and Monroe or La Crosse County? Do they come together and have bigger, more ambitious projects that they work on?
Huh, that's it. Okay, well, at the local level, we have the Driftless Area GIS Users Group, and that's open to anybody that's interested and or uses GIS. Mm-hmm. We typically meet on a once-to-two-year basis. We just were hosted by Jeremiah Erickson in Monroe County, but I believe the next time that that's going to be hosted will be in August in Richland County. So that's more of a group of just like anybody that's a GIS geography place kind of enthusiast to come together and talk about these things.
Does that include like drone people?
Yeah, it can include drone people. It's not exclusionary. And then we also have, in terms of like a broader expanse, like I'm thinking about we are part of the Wisconsin Regional Orthophotography Consortium, which is a bit of a mouthful.
What is ortho?
I knew what two of those words meant.
So that is the digital orthophotography. We talk about the aerial imagery. Okay. It means it's ortho-rectified, so it takes into consideration, you know, the oblique angle in which the imagery was captured, and whether or not it's geo-referenced. And so we are part of this consortium that's regionally pools together when we do these flyovers to capture this aerial imagery. For example, in 2025, there was flyover of Vernon County as well as Richland County. And through participation in the consortium, the cost was brought down for us because we had partnering counties doing it at the same time. So that's one initiative. One other example that I think about is statewide right now, we are converting our E911 data to what's referred to as next-gen 911 data, which is taking our data sets. I had mentioned earlier about site access and buildings, but that also includes boundaries for EMS, police and fire, MABUS, a variety of data sets that are used frequently by our dispatch offices. But what this initiative is having us, we're all using our own databases to collect this information. So the attributes that I might be storing may be different than, say, our neighbors in Crawford or Juneau County is storing. This is streamlining that process so all of our data sets are the same, mm-hmm. so that the information doesn't stop at the county boundary line. And so that's really exciting that we're working on this. And Vernon County is in that process right now. And the intention is to have all 72 counties working within this in the very near future. So that will also allow folks to be able to text and send photos to 911, which, you know, enables capabilities beyond a phone call.
Hmm. Very cool. It seems like your department has got hands in so many different things. Like it's because it's a source of information, so you know, you're not really controlling who's using that information. So whoever's like, oh, I could use a map that shows this, it could be something that you'd never really think of. And kind of on that note, is there a map that you made that was like, I never thought I would be gathering information to plot this? Like this seems a little bit out there. But yeah, sure, let's make it.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I'm super into that. I mean, you know, just a simple, silly map would be like mapping all of, like, I took the DNR data of their waterways, and I looked at the unnamed streams. I just made a map of the unnamed streams in Vernon County and passed it in the office. This is when I was in Land and Water, and said, okay, the DNR doesn't have names for these streams. Oh. Is there local, you know, in the vernacular, yeah. Do you have names? Oh, yes. Oh, you know, and then it was like, this is what we call that. This is what we call that one. And I loved, like, making that map.
That's so great. I mean, we were talking before we began recording here about, I was sharing the story of when I had my farm surveyed, and the guy came from with this digital technology on a tripod that was made in Switzerland and spoke to a satellite and could geolocate, I think it was within an inch or three quarters of an inch. And how amazing that was. And then we were bushwhacking. He had a machete and was literally like cutting down things so that I could follow behind him, helping him to carry the tripod. And that it really brought together like the most almost like primeval jungle dinosaur time feeling with the future of this talking to a satellite that is beyond my understanding. And I feel like when you tell the story about the streams, that kind of captures both of those, and then also the in-between time where, like, we are here making names for these things during our brief moment that we are part of this story, too. So thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, just because they're not captured by official, you know, entities doesn't mean that that they don't exist. And so I try to sometimes work to capture that lived experience or that local knowledge, I think, which is just as relevant and telling of place.
I love that. Like, what you do is just brings together so many different departments and so many different people, and I find it extremely interesting. My dad also, we've always had a globe in our house. Like, I never understood why, but he was just always fascinated with that, and so I think it's kind of in my blood to just be a little bit of a map nerd. So getting to hear about, you know, how you make them, the decisions that are made prior to, like, when you see a map, you don't think of, okay, this had to be thought of, discussed, maybe argued over, and then you go out and gather the data. So even before you start to do the technical part of it, there is a lot of human interaction that takes place that defines what the map is going to be. I hope that the people listening have maybe a new appreciation for, you know, both the Land Information Office as well as just maps in general, and understand that these are thoughtful, intelligent people that are creating these, so that we as a public can make thoughtful, intelligent decisions on our land use and all sorts of different things. And if you got a fire, it helps to get the fire department out to your house, which I guess I didn't really understand that either before this, but that's an extremely important thing. So we're gonna wrap up here, running just about an hour, and I'm sure we could probably talk another half hour or so about maps, but we'll let you get out of here, Monique. I really appreciate you coming in. Amy, I appreciate you coming in as well and sitting down with me. This has been the Crawford Stewardship Podcast. I'm your host, Joseph Childs, and today we sat down with Monique Hassman, the GIS coordinator, as well as a land information officer here in Vernon County at the Land Information Office. Thank you, Monique. I appreciate you coming in.
Thank you.